You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Soccer Report Extra podcast, and it is a little bit different this weekend due to technical difficulties or technical challenges. We'll call it technical challenges, and I'm in one end of the world and Owen's at another and Luke someplace else, so this is going to be a little bit different. Basically, I'll have my piece and then we'll hear from Owen, but there won't be any cross-chat this week. But let's get going. Number one story that broke on Friday, Arsene Wenger, after 22 years or so, pulling the plug on Arsenal. We'll hear a lot in the coming weeks, particularly with Europa League coming up and the end of the season, the tributes to Wenger, and I think they're incredibly well deserved. Anybody who's around and can remember Arsenal from the pre-Wenger days and realise how they're regarded now, it's basically a very, very different club. But I'd like to just take a little bit of time and talk about what might happen next. And perhaps rather, there's a lot of names being thrown around at the moment in terms of who might take over from Wenger at Arsenal. But sometimes we can get tied up in the names, and perhaps where we should really be looking is some of the skill sets and some of the things that a potential manager can bring. So I'm going to kind of throw out a few few suggestions anyway, the situation Arsenal finds themselves in, and perhaps what kind of manager and what skill sets that manager might have if they're going to turn Arsenal around. I think the first one that stands out like a sore thumb is you need somebody who can organise a defence. It's been the weak spot of Arsenal for a number of years. You go back to this decade, there's only twice in 2015, 2016, in 2013 as well, they've conceded less than 40 goals. And during that time, they've never conceded less than 36. They're already at 46 this year, another four games to go. So it's not inconceivable that they could be over the 50 mark by season's end. You compare that with their prime winning years, that first stint between 1998 and going into about 2005-2006, you saw a much more parsimonious Arsenal defence. There were a couple of years that stand out as being not so good. 2000, there was 43 goals against. I think they got good clubbing from Manchester United at least once in there. And then in 2003, they conceded 42. But you go through, and when they were competitive, they're basically conceding generally, you know, sometimes you're getting down as, I found this quite fascinating actually, going back to 1999, Arsenal defence only conceded 17 goals that year and just missed out to Manchester United, both in the league and then that classic semi-final in the cup as well. But only 17 goals against that year was the low point as far as, I guess you could maybe even say the high point as far as Arsenal defence was concerned. But generally you're looking at numbers, you know, when they won the league in 2004, it was 26 against, 2002, 36 against, 98, 33 against, and it seemed to hold up quite well. And then in 2010 it started dipping, and now it seems to be, you know, quite out of control. So I think number one, you have to look at somebody who's going to come in and organise the defence. Now, you know, on one level, that's much easier, I think, than being able to produce a team that's going to score some goals. At the moment, you've got Manchester City, you've got Liverpool, who have rattled up the most goals this year. Arsenal find themselves in amongst Manchester United, Chelsea, Tottenham, all scoring the same number of goals, or very similar, I should say. And I think you look at this team and you realise there are goals in this team, but how do you get the balance between going forward and attacking, scoring the goals and keeping it out the other end? So you're looking at somebody that can strike that balance and maintain that kind of attacking ethos that Arsenal have had for many years. I mean, I believe Lacazette can come right. I think you've in Ozil, there's a guy there that can continue to carve open defences. Ramsey, if he can bring some consistency And he's now getting to the age where he really has to be able to do that and produce some goals and find the right position for him. And then you look at some of the signings they just made in January. Mkhitaryan, I think, is could turn out to be a good signing. And Aubameyang has got goals in him as well. So I think from that forward line's perspective, I don't think there's necessarily a problem there, but they have to do something about the defence. And it's not just the back four, but it's that lack of a defensive shield that's hurt them over the last number of years. So organised defence is probably job one. I think the second thing you look at, and some of this might be tied into the defence as well, is you're looking at, I think, two, not necessarily mainstays of the defence, but two key areas of the defence that I think you've got to have some concerns about. When you look at Peter Cech, he has not had a good year. He's coming up for 36 next month, and I just wonder if Cech really is got another good couple of years in him that can help them reduce that number of goals conceded. The other one is, and I think it's probably a slower fade to black, but Laurent Koscielny is the injuries that he's playing with. I wouldn't be surprised if one of these times he just basically pulls a Per Mertesacker and announces that he's going to retire and he's had enough. So you look at Mustafi with his inconsistency. Mustafi should get better. I hope he gets better anyway. You look at his age, 26. Defenders should be maturing, generally a bit later than that. But I think the inconsistency is the thing that drives Arsenal fans up the wall as far as Mustafi is concerned. But Koscielny, I think they really need to find some cover there. They signed the young Greek player, Mavropanos, but we haven't seen anything of him, so really don't know. He's a pretty unknown quantity. The rest of the defence, Nacho Monreal is, he's probably, if anybody, he's probably been the player of the year as far as Arsenal's concerned this year. But you look at his age, he's beginning to push up there a little bit. He's already 32, that's a concern. Bellerin hasn't had a great year. I think the new manager's got to decide whether the stick or twist with Bellerin. That talks generally about the kind of the defensive side of it as far as Arsenal concerned. But I think the other piece, and Bellerin using that as maybe a little bit of an example, is one of the things I think that struck a lot of people in the latter parts of the Wenger years has been how many young players have stalled out. I think Oxlade-Chamberlain, Walcott were good examples of that. They've now departed. Jack Wilshere, you could argue it was injuries there. Aaron Ramsey, there's I don't think he's quite flowered to be the great player that he potentially could be. You're looking at some other players there, Callum Chambers. Sometimes you look at him and you think, yeah, he's ready to step up. He could make it to the next level. And other times you wonder if he could, you maybe might be best in a championship team. I think Rob Holding, just been there a couple of years, but the same questions get asked to him as well. You look at the next group of youngsters coming in. Maitland-Niles has come in. He's got pace. Playing as a midfield player, but he does go to sleep. He lacks that concentration sometimes, and it's a pretty heavy responsibility to put on a 20, 21 year old to ask him play in that defensive midfield role over an extended period of time in the season and come through. So, but you look for a manager to come in and be able to work with a player like that. The other one, you'd probably, Reece Nelson would be another one that would stand out. Joe Willock would be another one. So there's a number of younger players that are on the verge. Alex Iwobi, I think you've got to hope that the new manager can come in and get some improvement out of him and get a change, because he seems to be in a little bit of a spinning his wheels scenario at the moment. So overall, that would be the things I would be picking out about the replacement that is going to take over from Arsene Wenger. It's not an easy task, but it's not necessarily an impossible. It's not an impossible task either. One of the things that really makes it challenging, though, is to get back into the Champions League. Now, that may be done through Europa League. There is still a chance, although Atletico Madrid are a very imposing presence in front of Arsenal at the moment in that semi-final. But if that should come to pass and they get in through to the Champions League through the back door, that would be an incredible boost for a new manager coming in and free up a lot more transfer funds potentially as well. If that doesn't happen, then you would suggest it's probably going to be Europa League, although that's not even certain yet. Burnley have got to come to Emirates Stadium. But either way, getting back to that Champions League is vital for Arsenal in terms of revenue stream and being able to pay players and entice players to Emirates. You can see what it's done for Liverpool in terms of their financial position. It helps that they can sell a player like Coutinho at such a profit as well. But Liverpool this season, 17-18, will almost certainly overtake Arsenal in the revenue stakes. So that's my thoughts. If you've got any thoughts yourself, go to the Facebook page where you find the Soccer Report Extra podcast. And please feel free to share your thoughts and maybe toss in a couple of names.
Good evening to all of our very loyal listeners. As Bobby explained, slightly different episode this week because of geographical inconveniences. We cannot be in the same time zone as each other, so we're kind of trying to copy and paste some various aspects of our conversation and try to make it run coherently. And Arsene Wenger's pending departure from Arsenal obviously is the biggest storyline, and Bobby has touched on so many points very, very eloquently. There are a couple of things that I just wanted to touch on and wanted to make you possibly dwell on and ponder as you're enjoying your evening commute or your morning commute or your mid-afternoon commute, or you're just sitting on the toilet, however you consume this Soccer Report Extra podcast. We're all friends here, there is no judgment. But yes, I mean, firstly, the thing is the biggest thing that came to mind when the news filtered through was the timing of this. I found it very, very interesting that Arsenal's decision to and Arsene Wenger's decision to step away at the end of this season came right now in mid-April, because if we cast our minds back, the similarities in terms of Wenger and Sir Alex Ferguson's longevity at the respective clubs has always kind of binded them together. And here we are in Arsene Wenger's case, where you have to wonder how prepared the Arsenal top brass were that this was going to happen, because in an ideal situation, you would not be heading into a World Cup summer, and you would not be heading into a World Cup summer with this lack of time between Wenger's announcement and the tournament beginning, to try and have to make a decision and try and get somebody in. Because if you really scrutinise the timeline, Arsenal don't really have much wiggle room here. That World Cup disrupts plans for everybody. You think back to when Louis van Gaal was unveiled as Manchester United manager in the summer of 2014. He came in and quite inevitably that first season under him was particularly underwhelming, and there's not really much that you can expect there, because where his priorities are on a certain competition rather than what awaits him in the Premier League, and the recruitment process, all of that sort of stuff becomes very, very difficult to wrap your head around. So if Arsenal are looking at a successor, which they obviously are at the moment, you have to think that they need to tie this down very, very quickly. And the other thing is that in terms of an identity and a philosophy and a DNA to the club and DNA in terms of how to do things, you would think that it's going to be more of a patient, more of a calm, composed sort of process. But obviously, it's not going to be that way if their due diligence hasn't been in the works for some time, and if they didn't know this was going to actually happen. So I think that was the first thing that struck me as a little bit unusual. We'll obviously know the more and the further we get into this, just a little bit about the finer details of the conversations. Obviously, a lot of people speculating that Wenger was threatened with the sack. You have to say that the season has been very, very poor. Bobby touched on the defensive issues continuing. But ultimately, if Wenger was going to finish the season with a European title under his belt, which is still the case, you have to wonder, you know, would it have still been a bit of a head scratcher? Again, you go back to the Louis van Gaal situation. Yeah, you had somebody like Jose Mourinho waiting in the wings to take on that role, but Louis van Gaal still had won an FA Cup, but he gave Manchester United some silverware. So the fact that he was removed, even in the aftermath of that, was still relatively surprising. Whether or not Arsenal have somebody waiting in the wings of a similar ilk to Jose Mourinho is something else. But it's a very, very difficult one. I said on Twitter during the week that everything changes for Arsenal now, and we'll talk more about Wenger and what maybe awaits the club towards the very end of the season. But I have to say that we should probably take a few moments to reflect on the work that he has done at this club and where the club sits. You know, I was asked by a few people after the news came out about my thoughts on it, and you know, I did say to them, you know, we should think about what he walked into and the actual timeline involved with those early seasons. It was his first full season as Arsenal manager when they won the double, which, you know, you put that again into a modern context, it's absolutely you know, a ridiculous achievement. One of the things that's always levelled at Wenger is the fact that he inherited George Graham's team. Essentially, he didn't really change anything of it. That 1998 team had the same back five, Seaman in goal, and that iconic back four. The point of the matter is that when a new manager at any stage goes into a new team, the first instinct that he has is to change things. And what Wenger did was he tweaked things. Yes, he made some really astute moves and brought some new faces into that team, but he also acknowledged the greatest part of that Arsenal team was their defence. He built around that, and ultimately it was a very, very humble decision. He acknowledged the work that somebody else had done, the good work that someone else had done, and essentially painted around it. And he ended up being a double winner in 1998. What he inherited, you know, lest we forget, was not really a George Graham side. It was the ashes of a George Graham side, because the club was in complete disarray. You had Graham, who was sacked in humiliating circumstances. You had his replacement, Bruce Rioch, who effectively lasted one season before he was sacked. And you also had, in the dressing room, players like Tony Adams and Paul Merson, who were in the midst of personal crisis, both having addiction issues of their own. And that's not an easy situation for anybody to walk into. And added to that is the very fact that Arsene Wenger was a foreigner. He was an outsider. He was an outlier. And particularly when you look back at the early exchanges that he would have had with opposing managers, the level of xenophobia, not even a subtle amount of it, it's absolutely astounding. You go back on various quotes, even from the likes of Sir Alex Ferguson, who was a guy, he was an academic, he was supposedly more intelligent and brainier than all of these other English British coaches. Yeah, and here he was trying to put his stamp on things that were tried and tested. And that was a lot of the things that Wenger had to put up with in those early years before anyone really took him seriously. And suddenly, within what, probably 18 months, he was a Premier League title winner and FA Cup winner. It's a shame. I think I said it during the week that it was sad. It's sad to see that Wenger has walked away, and particularly in these circumstances where it's been incredibly disturbing, disgusting abuse that man has had to put up with. There is a very, very firm monument to him already and to the work that he's carried out, and it's called the Emirates Stadium. The Emirates Stadium would not have been built without Wenger, and that there's a couple of reasons why. Firstly, Arsenal, because of Wenger, were in the midst of a really, really incredible period of success, and it made sense for them to move. But also, when the banks were contacted in terms of handing out loans to Arsenal, the banks looked for a guarantee that Arsene Wenger would continue as Arsenal boss, and that money for that stadium would not have been passed through to Arsenal unless Wenger stayed put. In an era of quick fixes and in an era of bouncing from one to the other, essentially a bipolar society that we live in, that loyalty, that unwavering loyalty to the process and to the philosophy, is such an endearing thing that Wenger possessed. And for it to eventually prove to be his downfall is is just really upsetting, to be honest. Being punished for your footballing beliefs and very, very true and pure football beliefs, and ultimately, if this is perceived as failure in the last couple of years, perceived as a failure for Arsene Wenger, God Almighty, please let me taste some of that failure in my life. He's an absolutely fantastic coach, a revolutionary figure, and to see him walk away at the end of this season, he still has a lot of life in him, I think. He still has a lot of great things to bring elsewhere. It's just a shame that it won't still be in the Premier League.
That's the end of part one. Be back with part two shortly.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to part two of the Soccer Report Extra podcast. I explained just for part one, a little bit different this week, more like a little bit of an editorial with the fact that Owen's in far-off lands and technical challenges and the time zones just don't make it feasible to do what we usually do. But on to weekend in England, in particular, FA Cup, when in the Premier League, Liverpool dropped a couple of points with late goals to West Brom. Manchester City walloped Swansea, a couple of relegation battles going on. But really, the two big games on the weekend were Manchester United, Tottenham, and Chelsea, Southampton on the Sunday. Now, Chelsea, Southampton, Oliver Giroud continues to look like a pretty good buy for Chelsea. He's proven to be a pretty effective plan B, which he always was with Arsenal. But he got the go-ahead goal. Morata scored the clincher, if there need to be a clincher. And really, there wasn't really anything extraordinary about Chelsea's win. So they go forward to the FA Cup final. And in the FA Cup final, they will be playing Manchester United. 20th appearance in the final. And interesting game. It wasn't, I wouldn't describe it as a great game by any means, but it was a game that kept you interested. It was a game that always looked like it had a twist or two in it. A lot of the post-match comments about Tottenham Hotspur and Spurs failing to take that step to actually win the trophy. And Pochettino spent some time during the week perhaps downplaying the importance of the FA Cup, and that Tottenham perhaps were more interested in something along the lines of the Champions League and make sure they qualify for that. But it's now going on, it's probably past a decade since Tottenham Hotspur or Spurs won a trophy. And I think, personally, I think this is important. I think it was important for Spurs to go on and win something, rather being the bridesmaid, whether it be in the league or whether it be in the cup. This is something like the eighth now. Obviously, they're not all under Pochettino, but eighth time that Tottenham have lost in the FA Cup semi-final in recent times. And so they've done a good job of getting there, but actually taking that step and making it to the final and being able to lift a trophy, I think in terms of going opening their new stadium, keeping the younger players, who many of whom are admired by more or wealthier teams around Europe, I think it would be an important step to be able to demonstrate to everybody that Tottenham is improving and they are a team that's capable of challenging, not just challenging, but actually winning a trophy. So I'm not sure. I think Pochettino, I've kind of felt when he was making these comments, he was trying to get his excuses in early, which I don't think is ever a good thing. It's never a good look on anybody. But Tottenham got a fantastic start to the game in terms of Dele Alli scoring. It was a lovely worked goal, kind of goal that Dele Alli has scored a few of over the last couple of years. Good position, blind side run, getting in behind the defence, ball delivered to the back post, puts it in. Overall, it was a lovely goal and should have really been quite inspirational, I think, to Spurs at that time. Early goal, let's get going, you know, this might be our day. And then Sanchez comes back and scores just an absolutely superb header. And so with about half of the first half over, just a little over that, the game was back to 1-1. I think ultimately the most disappointing thing for Spurs fans must be after that is how anemic and Spurs looked after it became 1-1, and certainly in the second half. Harry Kane, whether it's injury or loss of form, I think the conventional wisdom is he is not returned to full fitness after that injury that he had, just never really looked like he was going to be influential in this game. Eriksen was as usual, the kind prime creator. Dembele, I thought, particularly in the second half before he was taken off, didn't play particularly well. Dyer was a bit inconsistent, and they just didn't have that flow. And of course, you had the master of making things difficult, let's be kind to Jose Mourinho, but making things difficult. The fact that Manchester United set themselves up very well, Paul Pogba certainly for periods of the game had great influence on the game. Sanchez looked like he'd been revived, and knowing the podcast, Owen and I have discussed this a number of times, how fatigued Sanchez might be, but he's had a little bit of a rest lately. I thought he was back to the kind of player that we've seen at Arsenal, chasing and harrying at his best, as opposed to period in Arsenal when he looked like he was chasing and harrying, but he was really had cut back his work rate considerably. Matic, Herrera, you know, the decent games. Lingard, before he went off, was buzzing around as he always does. Lukaku didn't get the goal, but perhaps had some influence on the outcome by miscontrolling the move during the move that led up to the winning goal, and then it just kind of landed at Herrera's feet, and whether he got a shout or not. The ball was left to run through to Herrera, and wouldn't say it was a great finish. I thought perhaps Vorm, who is, Lloris has his moments when he's not great. He has a habit of not performing well in big games, but I'm just not really ever been a big Michael Vorm fan. He had that good year at Swansea, and I've just felt that every time I see him playing for Spurs, that there's a chance, an increased chance, that Tottenham are going to let in maybe not soft goals, but goals that maybe classier goalkeepers and better goalkeepers might be able to hold on to. He kind of, Herrera hit it through Vorm more than anything else. So now what we have is, when Manchester City won the league, we've got Manchester City won the League Cup, and Manchester United potentially could do a Manchester sweep, if they can beat Chelsea in the FA Cup final. We'll have to wait to the end of May to see if that happens, but all in all, I thought value for money for Manchester United winning 2-1, and Tottenham, another season of semi-disappointment. They'll look at their performance in the league, the fact they made the Champions League, and that's a level of success, but still no trophy for Spurs.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan. Be sure to follow them both on Twitter. Links are in the show notes below. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to part three of the Soccer Report Extra podcast. A little bit different this week, but well into it now. Part three, want to talk a little bit about Barcelona, Sevilla, Copa del Rey final, and in particular, the performance, and is going to be one of his last performances, certainly his last performance in the final for Barcelona, Andres Iniesta, and the fact that it looks almost certain that he will be departing for the Chinese Super League in short order after the end of the season. The game itself, it was a case of the Sevilla just were really in it. Suarez got an early goal, Messi got set up beautifully, he makes it 2-0, 3-0 by half time, And really, as the commentator said, game over. Like, it really was dead as a contest after that. Then we had Anders Iniesta's goal, which, if you haven't seen it, try and track it down, because it's absolute beauty. It's so so Iniesta-like in terms of beautifully timed run, doesn't panic, kind of little swivel. Really, he takes an extra touch just to set the keeper down, takes it around and slots it in. It really was a pretty magnificent goal, and on an occasion like this, it was well worthy of a cup final. Now, Iniesta would get substituted later on in the game, just to essentially, the interesting part was getting a yellow card before that. He was quite upset that he'd been got hit off the ball as he was making a run, and finished up getting booked for dissension, which is quite Iniesta-like. But he got substituted with just a few minutes left, and I think it was really kind of interesting in terms of the reception he got, not just from Barcelona fans but from Sevilla fans, and that translated into cross social media after the game as well, because in Iniesta we are seeing the end of one of the great midfield players of his generation, and perhaps one of the greatest midfield players that Barcelona has ever produced and Spain has ever produced. His ability to, and I wrote a little bit about this in the Forbes article that I posted on Saturday night, I think it always stuck with me, a comment Gordon Strachan made in a podcast with Graeme Hunter, and if you ever get a chance to go back, it was a couple of years ago, but it really was a fantastic podcast, and Gordon Strachan was spectacularly good in it. But his comment about Anders Iniesta, and it was perhaps paraphrasing him just a little bit, but it was the case of what he admired about him was how brave he was, and it wasn't a physical bravery, but it was a mental bravery. And he said, you know, as a player, you always appreciate the players that don't bail on you, that don't go and hide when things don't go well or are under pressure. You're under pressure, they're under pressure, but they're willing to take that pass. They're willing to show for the pass. And Iniesta's ability to do that, and also so many times turn it into an attacking opportunity, to be able to swivel and pivot, being under pressure, and suddenly find that Barcelona or Spain were then going the other way and attacking the team, and as the opposition had perhaps tried to put press a little bit too high, and find out that they're suddenly on their heels as Iniesta is starting an attack. It was just one of the great things, I think, watching him down the years, and one of the things that'll always stick with me. Now, he's not going to retire. It looks like very much he's going to go to China, but I think as far as being on the big stage, I think we've got to consider, you know, this is the last few games of Iniesta. He's got Real Madrid coming in 2 weeks at the Camp Nou, so that's one more opportunity to watch him. He's also got, I guess, Barcelona could wrap up La Liga next week against Deportivo La Coruña. Obviously, Iniesta's retirement, or moving on to China, in fact he's leaving Barcelona, there's a reason, very much the reason, that Philip Coutinho has been signed. I thought he had actually quite a good game as well, so I think that kind of looks promising. Barcelona, I think, are still reeling from that exit in the Champions League, and even if they do the domestic double, and it'll be the ninth time in the history of the club that they have done the domestic double, but I think there will be a feeling that they came up short, that they could have done better this year. They could have gone all the way to Champions League final. They could have perhaps won it, but it's just not to be. But in terms of Iniesta, we're running out of games to watch him, and if you've got the opportunity to watch Barcelona in the next few weeks with Iniesta in the starting lineup, take it, because he has been, over the years, such a rare talent and such a beautiful, beautiful player to watch.
I just wanted to contribute a little bit to this conversation about Andres Iniesta. And, you know, it's a strange thing when you get to grow up in an era of watching truly great players, because usually it's always historical, right? I mean, I grew up and you read books and magazines with pictures of Pelé and Maradona and George Best and Johan Cruyff, and you always think to yourself, wow, you know, it would have been really special to be around and to have watched these guys up close. And in the present era, and even in the last number of years, as you've seen iconic players step away from the game, you take those moments to think, what an absolute pleasure it has been to watch these guys. And you're kind of living out what you've always perceived as a historical thing. It's kind of a weird feeling to have. And Iniesta is one of those players. I don't think he will ever carry the same profile, even in the future, in terms of his own legacy, that other more star-studded, more glittering players will carry. But in any great team, you always have those quiet guys whose talents were never underplayed, but it was their personalities that kind of almost counted against them. And you know, you think back to even your various Champions League winners and your European Cup winners and World Cup winners. You always had those guys who were very unassuming, and Iniesta perfectly fits that. I mean, his ability on a ball, his innate talent to do this. What I've always imagined about Iniesta, or always thought about him, is that he has the ability to make everything slow down around him. And that is, for anyone who's played the game, the speed of things is something that always separates the men from the boys. You know, everyone can go out on a Thursday night and play a five-a-side, it's fine. But when you're in a game and playing to any high level, you cannot take a third touch. You cannot, that sort of mechanical movement is just not something that you can do. And so when you mix quickness of movement physically and quickness of movement mentally together, and you have that package, it's like you've cracked a code. And Iniesta is essentially the perfect secret agent, if that's the analogy that we're using, because his ability to think so crisply and quickly and to play these incredible passes, he has the vision and he's got the understanding of the game, and to do all of this and to make it look so effortless. Because people look at him and look at his body language and think, well, he's barely moving. And that's really where you get someone, right? When you sell them on the myth that you're barely moving. It's you know, it's like those players who, it looked as if they were playing a game in velvet slippers. You know, it was these beautiful, you know, I suppose, you know, for anyone from a British background or whatever, you know, the one thing is a Bobby Moore or a Rio Ferdinand as a centre half, it looks like they're just, you know, slowly just, you know, like a balletic grace moving around the pitch. And Iniesta is exactly like that. It just looks like it just is so natural. And it's the one thing I would say, and I'm just throwing this out there for any listener who's, you know, grasps onto this, you know, in terms of what this does to your perception of a player. It happened with a few of them. It happened with Xavi beforehand. It even happened with Pep Guardiola. You kind of go back. Is if Iniesta steps away from Barcelona and takes on and finishes career in a kind of a footballing backwater. You know, if he goes to a China or if he goes to the Middle East, you know, how do you feel about that? And I guess that I thought that I cared a lot about it. And then you compare it to other players down through history who always did it. And you think, well, you know, I'm not sure that I care too much about it. But I just thought, for the purposes of podcast, where we try and stir things and stir a little bit of a different way of thinking, it was something for you, dear listeners, to think about. Does it spoil how you think of him? Or do you look at it as, wherever you are in the world, be it the China League or the Middle East, is it something great that they get to experience now? And it's a kind of another fine reflection of football as a truly international game, that these people get to bring their kids to matches where Andres Iniesta is patrolling a centre field. A truly beautiful player, a wonderful player, and again, we come back to the original point of this conversation. Such a pleasure to have watched them over the last decade or even longer. And that moment against the Netherlands, I guess, is that defining moment of his career. It's weird how you can probably sell somebody on just one thing they've done. Everything with Barcelona was part of the collective. It was part of the collaboration. And yet, in a World Cup final, that most special of spaces, Iniesta gets to have his one defining moment. Just him, alone. He is the game winner. He is the person that's brought this to his country. And that's one thing you'd say about him. At least he has that, that we remember the individual, and we remember a high-profile moment involving that individual. And even though he's done everything and he's won everything, he does get to have that photograph on his wall or whatever it is, and his kids get to hang on to it as that one special memory, where he gets to be very arrogant about it and he gets to have that ego. Not that he would probably ever dwell on that, but it is nice for neutral football fans to appreciate that even Andres Iniesta, as humble as he was, got to have his one amazing, powerful, gripping moment in the spotlight.
Thank you very much, Owen. That brings us to the end of the Soccer Report Extra podcast for this week. We will be back next week, and we hope you will join us. Thank you very much. For someone who's so keen to snuggle, you
cause a lot of trouble. Thanks for listening to Soccer Report Extra. To keep tabs on the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen, like us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Music for this podcast graciously provided by Manitoba's hottest indie pop group, Misery Slims. Check them out on Spotify and YouTube, and follow the band on Facebook at Misery Slims.